Welcome to the Catskill Review of Books, a weekly program interviewing authors, hosted by Ian Williams and produced by Kevin Greff in the hydro-powered studios of WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.
Hello, this is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and this week it is my great pleasure to talk to Philip Green, who is the founder and curator of the Museum of the American Cocktail, which has got to be one of the more fun museums, not part of the Smithsonian, I gather, and he has recently produced a fascinating book, To Have and Have Another, A Hemingway Cocktail Companion. And, of course, Ernest Hemingway made many cocktails his companions, Phil. So apart from your love of the American cocktail, you're an aficionado of the old man himself, aren't you?
Indeed. I fell in with Hemingway before I was old enough to drink, so that it sort of predates any interest in cocktails. And just to clarify, I don't want to offend our curator. I'm one of the founders of the Museum of the American Cocktail, but Ted, Dr. Cocktail Hay, is the curator, and he does an amazing job.
So. My apologies, Ted. I'll buy you a drink next time I'm down.
Thank you for the compliment, though. But yes, Hemingway. In high school, started to admire his compelling way of writing and the way, especially the way he described things. And if it's describing, you know, a campfire or a backpacking trip or how he would catch fish or food and drink, it was something that attracted me to him. And then as I read more and started to develop an interest in drinks, I started keeping track of all the different drinks that his characters were having, and it went from there.
A true labor of love.
Indeed, yes.
One of the more admirable bits here, I think in my own book on rum, I debunked the Bacardi-inspired publicity stunt that it was about the foundations of Cuba Libre with Bacardi. But you've done a similar job on the mojito here. You know, it's the drink is often associated with Hemingway, and you claim that no proven connection whatsoever.
Well, it's one of those things where you can't prove a negative. You know, the old joke about, you can't prove that, you know, you don't beat your wife. You know, well, I didn't beat her yesterday. It's one of those things where I can't prove that he never had a mojito. He may well have had a mojito, and one of the drinks in the book is very similar to one. It's just made with honey instead of sugar. But, you know, Hemingway tended to write about what he enjoyed in his own life, and you never see, you know, you see plenty of mentions of Bloody Marys or martinis or daiquiris or whiskey throughout his prose, his letters, his journalism. You know, absinthe is all over the place, the scotch and soda. Not one reference in anything he's ever written that I've been able to find to the mojito. And then the fact is that by the time he was living in Cuba, he was disdaining sugar. He didn't take sugar in his drinks. He would make an Irish whiskey sour without sugar. He'd make a daiquiri without sugar, and the mojito typically has an ounce of simple syrup. And I've had handwriting experts look at the wall hanging at the La Bodeguita del Medeo in Havana that says my daiquiri in the Floridita and my mojito at La Bodeguita, and they've said it looks kind of like his handwriting, but it's probably a forgery. So it's a very nice marketing scheme, apparently, but and it's brought tons of tourists into that little bodega, but it's probably not the truth. Nevertheless, if you Google the terms Hemingway and mojito, you'll get tens of thousands of hits, all proclaiming it to be his favorite cocktail. So,
yeah, but not one of them written by him.
Correct.
Yeah. It's interesting that you're also saying here that the Bodeguita, which, as you say, is a great tourist trap, no proven connection there either.
No, in my book I mentioned that I've either talked to friends of his or I've quoted friends of his as saying, look, he went to the Floridita, he went in Sloppy Joe's on rare occasions, you know, primarily to meet Noel Coward or Sir Alec Guinness during the filming of Our Man in Havana. you know, there was the Hermosa, the La Terraza. There were other bars and restaurants that he went to, but he did not go to the Bodeguita, as far as they knew. You know, and I think there's even some evidence that suggests that it wasn't even a bar back then; it was a little grocery store. But I didn't dig that deeply into the research. But it's just one of those many myths that I've always enjoyed debunking. One of them about one of my own ancestors, Antoine Peychaud, that he probably did not invent the cocktail. In fact, if he had, he would have been about 3 years old. But
Well, that's something I think that we can. I mean, it strays a bit from Hemingway, but you know, the whole idea of a cocktail. You mentioned, and I agree with you, that there's the old tradition of the Caribbean and the South was this mixture of citrus, sugar, and spirit, especially rum, of course. And, you know, I presume the tea punch or the julep or the others, was that the foundation of the modern cocktail where ingenuity knows no bounds?
You could certainly argue that. I mean, you look at what's the foundation of the mojito, the Drac, you know, Sir Francis Drake. If it was that Drake or another Drake, you know, the whole story of trying to raid the gold supply of Cuba and being turned away and to drown their sorrows, they made a mixture of crude rum and mint and sugar. You look at you know, the 1740s and Admiral Vernon of the Royal Navy serving grog to his men. Isn't that the basis of a daiquiri? You know, a little bit of lemon juice or lime juice mixed in with their daily ration of rum with perhaps some sugar to sweeten it. Who knows? You know, the cocktail as we look at it here in the United States is something that we see the term first defined in 1806. So that's sort of what we hang our hat on. But, you know, my friends Anastasia and Jared Brown and Anastasia Miller have pointed to references from the UK that possibly predate that. You know, it's inevitable that you're going to have a mixture of spirits and, you know, bitters and sweetener and call, you know, punch could be the predecessor going back to the 16th century, something like that.
One of the things to bear in mind, I suppose, is that spirits, apart possibly from cognac in the old days, were pretty crude firewater stuff, and people always drank them mixed.
Sure. I think one of the lines of demarcation is probably the addition of bitters, which, you know, in the original definition in 1806 in the Balance and Columbian Repository, referred to as a bittered sling, the cocktail is spirits of any kind, sugar, water, and bitters. So the cocktail geeks among us will point to the addition of bitters as being the essential part of a properly made cocktail.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, going through this list of the concoctions that Hemingway described or drank, I don't really see many mentions of actually drinking straight spirits anywhere.
Plenty of that. I try to keep this in the context of a recipe book, but there are plenty of places where, in The Old Man and the Sea, the To Have and Have Not, where the protagonist is taking a sip of rum. Or a sip of whiskey in many, many other places, or drinking brandy straight.
And you mentioned when we were talking some time ago about the tequila for his steering drink.
Exactly. Tequila, when he was out on Pilar, his beloved 48-foot cruiser out on the Gulf Stream, he would often navigate, you know, one bottle north of Bacardi and two bottles of Facundo or something like that. And he would also refer to tequila as his steering liquor. Well, you know, during heavy seas, the tequila would somehow keep him on his feet. Seems a bit counterintuitive, but it worked for him, I suppose. But yeah, he did like to sip tequila as he was steering the Pilar.
Mm-hmm. And this was at a time when most tequilas were so crude that people had to have the lemon and the salt, the lime and the salt to imbibe them.
Could be. Yeah, this would have been probably back in the 1940s and 50s that he was doing that.
Yeah. You mentioned that William, I think you go over this, and Hemingway was very dismissive of William Faulkner, who drank while he was writing and claimed he could detect where Faulkner had started to drink in the middle of a page. But he himself actually kept the writing and the tippling completely separate, you say?
For the most part. Again, I can't prove it, but every interview I've read and what you see in his prose, there's a great deal of reference to the discipline of writing and that you would only write... you would write while you were, before you wouldn't drink while you were writing, in other words, and that was something you had to do cold. He described that in a letter to Ivan Kashkin in 1935. You couldn't mix the two, but drinking was something you would do after you were finished writing. Writing would leave him, he was so spent after a morning of writing that he felt like a wrung out dish rag, and drinking was a way of helping him think through what he was writing, change his ideas, put his ideas on a different plane, and also sort of help to refill the creative juices in the well.
Oh, I mean, speaking of the juices, the amount he drank, he must have had some mother of all hangovers in the morning when he was pounding at the typewriter sometimes.
He would sometimes refer to them as mastodon hangovers, and he had some great one-liners in writing letters to his friends. He'd say something like, "I have a terrific hangover right now. I wish you were here with me, and I'd split it with you," something like that. But, that was his way of sort of paying his dues was I suppose, with the hangovers that he occasionally had.
Mm-hmm. This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Booze, I think we are this week, talking to Phil Green about his book To Have and Have Another, a Hemingway cocktail companion. One of the drinks you mentioned in there, which is coming back into legality and fashion, is absinthe, and you sort of... You hint in there that this was one of those great moral panics which had absolutely no basis in sort of pharmaceutical fact. Is that the...
That's my understanding of absinthe, is that at the turn of the last century, you started to see the rise of the Temperance League, or the people who wanted to outlaw alcohol. You had a complete lack of control, quality control or legal controls on labeling. So you had a lot of spirits that were labeled as absinthe, but really weren't, and some of them might have even been toxic, probably were. And you had this horrific incident, I think, in 1909, thereabouts, where a French peasant spent the day drinking, but because he had absinthe toward the end of that binge, he ended up going home and murdering his wife and family, and the authorities blamed it on the absinthe. They called it the absinthe murders. So the absinthe became sort of the scapegoat. It was in 1912, it became pretty much universally banned, and they sort of pointed particularly at thujone, the wormwood, the chemical compound that is part of absinthe, and making the case that it was hallucinogenic or addictive or dangerous in many other ways. It was only 6 or 7 years ago that it's become legal again, and in part due to my friend Ted Brough and his efforts. He's a chemist, and was able to analyze properly made pre-prohibition absinthe, particularly by Pernod and other producers, and determined that there was nothing, chemically unsafe about it, no more than any other strong spirit. Of course, it's very high proof. You have to be careful with it. But as long as the thujone is at safe, parts per million levels, then it's entirely safe.
Of course, there are some people who probably regret the idea that it isn't hallucinogenic.
It's funny. You always hear about the runner's high that a runner will have, or the green flash that'll happen when the sun sets, and or seeing the green fairy and all. And I've never had any of those three. I see the sunset and it's the same color, and I've run 10 miles at a time, and I've never felt the endorphins kick in, and I've never seen the green fairy. But that was what fueled the great poets and painters of the 19th and early 20th century. So. And you see in Hemingway's prose the great lengths that his characters would go to have the real absinthe, but it had to be hidden by the waiter, and he would bring it to the table in an ordinary Pernod bottle, sort of wink, wink, nudge, nudge, and they couldn't even do the proper setup because the authorities might be alerted if they saw the dripping glass, and so they would have to sort of use a makeshift, a structure of saucers and crushed ice and that sort of thing.
But it must have, of course, the thrill of illegality must have improved the flavor no end.
It could have, the old forbidden fruit, exactly.
What, of course, Hemingway actually blew off his head with a shotgun in the end.
Lead poisoning, I call it, yes.
Yes, being the prohibitionist sentiment probably says there's a connection here. I mean, that he killed himself because he was a heavy drinker.
I don't know if it was because it certainly didn't help his overall state of health. Nowadays we're looking at professional athletes, particularly pro football players, American football players, and seeing the terrible toll that concussions have levied on them. Hemingway had probably 10 or 12 concussions in his life, from a skylight falling on his head in Paris in his 20s, to a few car accidents, to two plane crashes in Africa in 1954. And, there's also the thought that, he had depression and suicidal tendencies running in his family. His father took his own life when Hemingway was 29, I think. His sister did as well. His brother did also. He was suffering from hypertension, diabetes. Just the toll of his sort of rough and tumble life left him at the end kind of a physical wreck. The Mayo Clinic was giving him tremendous amounts of electroshock therapy at the very end, and he was sort of a shell of his former self. So the drinking certainly didn't help, but it. He always said, if I can't write anymore, I don't see any point in living. And he could no longer write. He just was no longer what he used to be at age 61.
Which is relatively young by current standards, isn't it, of course?
True, but you look at a lot of his contemporaries, and Fitzgerald didn't live that long. A lot of the great, the members of the Lost Generation had predeceased him. So he kind of did all right for that era, it took a great toll on the creative minds of that generation.
Yeah, and since he died in Cuba, one of the points was that he was actually quite pally with Fidel Castro, wasn't he, towards the end?
Well, he actually had to leave. He died in Idaho, but he had to leave Cuba because he no longer felt safe living in Cuba's Castro's Cuba. He in the early days he wasn't particularly he embraced Castro. He thought he might be a good alternative to the
Batista,
the brutal regime of Batista. But I think he quickly saw that it was sort of out of the fire and into the frying pan, or vice versa with Castro. And he left Cuba, left his boat behind, left the finca, his house there, and I think that also led to his depression. The feeling that he couldn't go back to his beloved Cuba.
I know there are apocryphal stories I've heard in Havana about how the two of them would go fishing and Hemingway would let Fidel catch the big ones because he appreciated it would be dangerous.
That Castro held and invited Hemingway to be sort of a guest participant, and I think Castro did win. Whether or not it was rigged, I don't know. There are photographs of them holding a fishing trophy. That was probably around 1960.
Yes, I actually interviewed one of his barmen there when I was there, who was living in very dire circumstances in the ruins of what was once a posh luxury apartment with mold and mildew over his clippings.
So among the drinks in your reading of the book, what jumped out at you as one you might fancy?
Well, there were several of them. I was looking at... the names are wonderful for a start, aren't they?
I wanted to come up with myself, like the physician healed myself, that was based on a drawing that Hemingway had, that of all things was in his medical files, a drawing of a glass mark, you know, showing fill it up to here with sherry, up to here with whiskey, and fill it up to here with champagne. And it's actually not a bad drink. And I also gave the name of the Josie Russell to a drink that was created on his friend Sloppy Joe Russell's boat, the Anita. He kept Hemingway kept fishing logs of of their fishing trips, and he, you know, just wrote down cocktail, three jiggers of rum, lime, a bottle of cider, and 2 spoons of sugar. This was the early days when he was still using sugar. But yeah, some of them I had to come up with the name, but other ones he might have done himself. You know, Death in the Gulf Stream or Death in the Afternoon. There's some pretty colorful names in there.
Yes, and lots of them you've named after a bunch of bananas and a bottle of gin. Is one of your chapter titles.
Right, he loves gin and coconut water, and there was a novelty song written by Ogden Nash and performed by Jose Ferrer and Rosemary Clooney with that name, A Bunch of Bananas and a Bottle of Gin. And it has to do with a story, probably apocryphal, but based on fact, where his plane crashed in the jungles of Africa. And, you know, everyone thought he was dead, but he marched out of the jungle with a bottle of Gordon's gin in one arm and a bunch of bananas in the other. And he says to whoever would listen, "My luck, she is running very good." So that became sort of the tagline of the song. Not a very good song, but story.
Yeah. You mentioned the coconut water, and it's something you don't often see in cocktails.
Well, you're starting to see it more often now, but yeah, that's one of the original drinks that he came up with. It was either gin and coconut. Well, gin and coconut water was sort of a standard around the Caribbean, but his improvement was to add Angostura bitters and lime juice, and he called it the Green Isaac Special, named after Great Isaac and Little Isaac Key, which is just north of Bimini in the Bahamas. This was from islands in the stream, and that's a very nice drink. It's one of the first Hemingway drinks that I ever made, and what sort of got me more interested in trying to crack the code or figure out what drinks his characters were drinking. But it's a very nice drink, and coconut water, of course, nowadays has become very popular either as a hangover remedy or to replace your electrolytes or, you know, after a workout, that sort of thing. So it's flying off the shelves.
With your part in the Museum of the American Cocktail, the cocktail seems to be having a renaissance, because for many years it was something that people associated with the 50s, 60s, you know, the cocktail for the breadwinner on his return home. But now there's barrel-aged cocktails, there's incredibly complex mixes, liquid nitrogen infusions, smashing stuff up.
Yeah, the old molecular mixology and things like that. I try to steer clear of those, but no, you're absolutely right. Starting in the 90s, we've seen a great renaissance in bartending as a craft, not necessarily just something you do while you're working your way through college or something like that. And it's great to see. I mean, you know, for many years restaurants have relied on the bar tab as being a big part of the bill, but they would hire just about anybody off the street to mix drinks. And you know, in the 1980s, when I was starting to drink mixed drinks, it was mostly highballs, you know, and martinis and Sazeracs and things like that were something our parents might drink. But we've seen it come full circle. I think as the palate of Americans and people around the world has continued to mature, we're eating better, we're drinking better wines, we're drinking better coffees, and eating better breads and you know, gourmet foods, and we're focused on the preparation and the craft behind it and the stories behind it. So yeah, I think that's all part of it.
Well, this is where I think your book is sort of invaluable for the would-be bartenders and mixologists, because of course every one of your mixes has a story or two or three behind it.
Oh, thank you. Well, that's what I've always found compelling is the stories behind the drinks, and that's what we do in our seminar program with the Museum of the American Cocktail. We show you how to make the drink in the proper method, but also tell the stories. We identify it as folklore when we think it is, but you know, George Washington, did he really chop down the cherry tree? Who cares? You know, was Excalibur really pulled out of the stone? That sort of thing. It's all great storytelling, but in a lot of cases, you know, they're based in truth, and it adds value to the enjoyment of the drink.
Yeah. Performance is a large part of cocktail making, isn't it? When you see a master craftsman sort of gyrating around.
If they're making a good drink, I think it's great. And if you recognize it as just the acrobatics or the juggling, that's fine too. But it's a shame if Tom Cruise or whoever is making a really lousy drink. But yes, I mean, flair bartending goes back to the days of Jerry Thomas, making the Blue Blazer, throwing this flaming, stream of brandy or whiskey from one glass to mug to another. So flair bartending certainly has its rightful place in mixology. In my view, the end result should be a good performance and a good drink. So.
Well, of course. So was in the course of all of this, you had to reread Hemingway. So it's. You've advanced your own personal scholarship glass by glass. I presume it fixes it in the memory when you have to mix up each of the drinks you discover in there.
Indeed. And of course, my kids, they'll come home from high school or college and say, "Oh, Daddy, I need to borrow Farewell to Arms. We're going to be reading it in class this semester." And they're going to pull a volume off the shelf with underlines of every drinking reference. So I should probably buy a fresh set of all the books, but it wasn't hard work to reread all the Hemingway and also dig deeply into either his published or unpublished letters, the fishing log books, the contemporaneous cocktail books, the Harry Craddock book, the Harry McElhone book, all the books that were available to him back in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. Wanting to try to place these recipes within the proper time frame and context.
How long did this labor of love take you, and how did your liver fare?
I started collecting, references probably back in throughout the 90s, and I finally had the idea of writing the book around 2004, 2005, and I presented my first seminar, Tales of the Cocktail, in 2008, and then it was 2009 that I really started.
Tales of the Cocktail, we should explain to the listeners, is a major fest in New Orleans every year where it's the world's cocktail aficionados gather to make and drink cocktails.
Right, this year it's July 17th to 21st, but it is a collection of some of the best of the lot of bartenders, spirit companies, brand ambassadors, writers, bloggers, you name it. It's a great, great time. And I'm doing an event this year, a Hemingway seminar on Paris in the 1920s, the Lost Generation, the cocktails of the Lost Generation. It will feature Hemingway, but also talk about, Dos Passos and Picasso and Gertrude Stein and James Joyce and F. Scott Fitzgerald and all the other characters of 1920s Paris. But it is a great event. It's been there since I think 2003.
Phil, that's all we have time for. This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and I've been speaking to Philip Green about his book To Have and Have Another, A Hemingway Cocktail Companion, in which he proves that literary criticism need not be a dry subject. Thanks, Phil.
Thank you very much.
Listen in next week to the Catskill Review of Books from WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.